Well, welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us. An unusual first meeting for CMAC in 2020, but let's, I suggest, move on to the first technical agenda item, which we have, which is on primary financial statements, and I'll hand over to Carleen.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Carleen Konings, and I'm a member of the technical staff at the ISB working on the Primary Financial Statements project. And I will be taking you through the key proposals that are in our exposure draft general presentation and disclosures, which was published in December last year and is currently out for comment until the end of June. Now, I know some of you will have heard this presentation or a similar presentation before at earlier stages of the project, so I'll try to keep it fairly high level. The aim of this session is also to give you an opportunity to ask us any questions you have about the proposals and also to provide us with your initial views on the proposals, but you'll have another opportunity to provide feedback on these proposals at the joint CMAC-GPF meeting in June. So we have a number of topics to discuss in this session, and the plan is that I'll present one topic and then we open up for discussion and questions on that topic, and then we repeat that for every topic. So and then there are also some aspects on our proposals where we're particularly keen to get users' views on, so I'll try to highlight those throughout my presentation. So slides 7 and 8 of the slide deck provide some background about the project and how it came about, but I suggest we go straight to slide 9. So right at the start of the project, we did a lot of outreach with users to help us determine the right project scope, and a few common themes emerged from that user feedback, which are in the left column on that slide 9. And the slide tries to show that each of our 4 main sets of project proposals respond directly to user explained those. In 4 sets of proposals that we will be discussing are, first of all, the introduction of defined subtotals in the statement of profit or loss. Then secondly, strengthening the requirements for disaggregating information. Then the third set of proposals relates to management performance measures. And then finally, the statement of cash flows. So let's start with the first topic on slide 11. So what is the issue here? Well, users have repeatedly expressed the concern that the structure and the content of the statements of financial performance varies between companies and even between companies in the same industry. So the problem lies partially in the standards. So the standards only require companies to present revenue at the moment and profit or loss, but the standards don't require any specific subtotals to be presented in between those two. And so we see that in practice, many companies do present such intermediate subtotals. And while those companies often use the same labels for those subtotals, such as operating profit, they're defined in many different ways. So for example, in a sample of 100 companies that we looked at, we found 63 operating profits. And among those, at least 9 different definitions were used. And so that makes it very difficult for investors to assess and compare performance across companies. So in other words, investors were asking for more comparability there. And so what the board is proposing is to introduce a more comparable structure in the statement of profit or loss with defined subtotals and defined categories, which is shown on slide 12. And the board proposes 3 subtotals and 4 categories. And the new subtotals are highlighted on the left in sort of brown, and then on the right-hand side in the boxes, you've got the defined new categories. And this illustration shows a possible presentation for a company using an analysis of expenses by nature, but it's just an example, so not all of the line items would be required line items. And also, this example is meant to illustrate the proposals for most companies, but we'll come on to how our proposals work for specific companies like banks and insurers later on. So if we start from the top, you see we have an operating category and an operating profit subtotal. And so as I've said before, the operating profit is a very commonly used subtotal. So we think the board providing a definition there would be a very important improvement to financial reporting. And the board's intention for that operating profit subtotal and category is for it to include the income and expenses from an entity's main business activities. But the board has defined this category not positively by defining what are main business activities, but it has defined it as a residual, which means that effectively everything that doesn't fit into any of the other categories at the bottom would go into operating. Then the lowest of the three subtotals, so that is profit before financing and income tax, that subtotal is intended to enable investors to analyze a company's performance before the effect of its financing activities. So below that subtotal in the financing category, you'll find things like interest expenses on financing liabilities, but also things like the unwinding of the discounts on liabilities, such as pensions, provisions. And then finally, there's also in that category, there will be the income and expenses on cash and cash equivalents, though that's not shown in the example. And so I want to highlight here specifically on those two last things I mentioned, so the unwinding and cash equivalents. We've been getting some pushback from preparers, with some suggesting that there should be some more flexibility there or some optionality as to where those are classified. So if in your comments you could provide your views on whether it would be helpful to have this optionality or whether you would prefer to retain that they're in the same place for all entities, that would be very helpful. Then above the profit before financing and income tax subtotal, we have the investing category. That's a fairly new idea. So the aim of that category is to capture income and expenses from investments that generate returns independently from the company's other assets and that users tend to value separately. So we expect to see things there like returns on financial instruments and on investment properties. And so that leaves me with the very long subtotal in the middle, operating profits and income and expenses from integral associates and joint ventures, and the integral category above that. So that's discussed in more detail on slide 14. So what we've heard about users from about associates and joint ventures is that they tend to value them separately. The share of profit or loss from associates and joint ventures is very different from the rest of the P&L because it's a net number, it's an after-tax number. So investors prefer the results from associates and joint ventures to be outside operating profit. But then on the other hand, we've heard from companies that they view some investments in associates and joint ventures as integral to their business, and they would like to include the share in their operating profit. And so what we ended up with is a sort of compromise solution, I would say, where we say that all associates and joint ventures are excluded from operating profit, but the integral ones are presented slightly closer to operating profit and are included in this separate subtotal. So companies would be able to present those a little bit more prominently. Again, we have been receiving some pushback on this proposal about the split between integral and non-integral, because some stakeholders are concerned that this split would require a lot of judgment. And so it would be helpful if in your response you could express how strongly you support this split and whether you feel it provides useful information. Then if we look at slide 15, that's about EBITDA, which is a topic that usually generates a lot of interest from investors. So you will have noticed that EBITDA is not one of the three subtotals that we're proposing to require in the income statement. And so the board has a number of reasons for not going there. So the main reason is that the board couldn't really identify a conceptual underpinning for EBITDA, other than it being a useful starting point for various analysis. And so slide 16 shows that we found that EBITDA is defined in many different ways in practice. So both what subtotal is used as the starting point varies, and what types of adjustments go into the DA bit of EBITDA varies. And so without a conceptual underpinning, it was very difficult for the board to identify what would be the right definition for EBITDA. However, what the board has done is it has defined a measure that's quite similar to EBITDA. So it has defined operating profit before depreciation and amortization. And that would be a comparable measure that entities can voluntarily provide in the financial statements without having to provide the MPM disclosures, which we'll come on to later. The board did consider using the term EBITDA for that measure, but because the content of that measure doesn't exactly match what the acronym EBITDA stands for, it decided not to go there. And then finally, if we look at slides 17 and 18, so it's clear that our general model that we looked at earlier on slide 12 wouldn't work for all companies. So the board has identified some principles that describe specific circumstances in which companies such as banks could move up items from the investing and the financing categories. So our aim is really to allow companies like banks and insurers to pretty much continue what they're doing today. So the example on slide 18 doesn't really look very different from what banks are doing today. So you see, we expect them to include interest expenses in operating profits and also include their net trading income and net investment income in operating profit, which means that for a bank, probably the operating profit will be very close to profit before tax. So in this example, the company only has the associates and joint ventures that sit between operating profits and profit before tax. So that's all I wanted to say about that first section on subtotals. So that brings us to the first set of questions, which is on slide 19. And again, I would like to highlight, it would be particularly helpful if you could tell us about how you feel about avoiding optionality for the classification of expenses such as the unwinding of a discount and income and cash equivalents, and then also whether you feel strongly about this split between integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures.
Okay, thank you, Colleen. So let's just try and organize this effectively. So if I can see you, so if you're on VC, if you want to speak to this question, could you just raise your hand now? Okay, thank you, Florian. And then if you have dialed in, can you just let me know if you want to speak to this question? If you could just mention your name, please.
Hi, I'm Marietta. I'd like to speak. Thank you.
Jeremy here. Please, could I speak as well?
Yes, of course. Anyone else would like to speak?
Yes, therefore,
sorry?
I'd like to speak. Therefore, on the phone now.
Bertram, yeah.
Yes.
That was Bertram. Yep, lovely.
Yes.
Okay.
I have some.
Okay. Fantastic. Jeremy, would you like to start then?
Oh, thank you very much. So, firstly, I think it's extremely helpful to have the extra subtotals. In the point of income and cash and cash equivalents, I think there is a justification that sometimes that's operating. So, for example, a payroll company where a large part of their income is interest on the float, that's reasonable to put in operating profit. So I suppose it all depends on if you classify cash as operating or financing. In terms of the split of integral and non-integral, that doesn't really affect the way I look at companies. So I would treat all of the joint ventures and associates and look at the big items there separately in any event. One question of clarification. You mentioned that the category that has underinvesting, that part there, are independent operations. Is it also the case that it excludes any consolidated operations? So all consolidated results appear in operating profit. And my last point is, I think it would be very helpful for the D&A to be maybe a supplemental information to be given. So just the depreciation charge for the year and the amortization charge for the year, excluding impairment.
Okay. Thank you, Jeremy. Colleen, do you want to respond to, perhaps you respond to any questions once we've gone through this round with everyone, if that's okay? Florian.
Yes, thank you. Just two little comments. I think I would prefer to have everything under the financing categories at the same point, unless they clearly define which of the financing activities are operating. Right, in the, your example, you have the OEM, which also provides financing. I think it needs to, the optionality has to be that they clearly define which part of their business, which part of their sort of financing part of the business is operating, and then only include that as separate line items within the operating part, but clearly delineated as you show in the example that you have provided with the larger thing, right? I don't think there can be any optionality, you know, that must be the max in terms of optionality. I have every smaller, maybe not that interesting comment, but maybe we can find another name for investing, because it's what you, to just to avoid some confusion with the cash flow statement, right? What you're thinking about in investing here is non-operating activities kind of adjacent to what it is that the company does. So maybe we can just find another word for investing to make clear that this is something different from the cash flow statement that we're talking about, right? And then I think on in terms of it would be helpful to see some examples around hedge accounting and how that would work, if how much of that you think is really part of the integral operations, or if you would rather put this under the financing side. That's it from my side. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's go to Marietta next, please.
Yeah, so three comments, please. The first is on the optionality on things like discount unwinds. I think you should avoid that wherever possible, just because for an analyst, it's already quite difficult to track all this through the P&L, especially if, you know, a company has a lot of contingent consideration liabilities and so forth. And a lot of times, you know, this is not disclosed in sufficient detail to begin with, and then you're not sure what flows to what line. And, you know, a lot of times even IR then gets confused. And I just think, you know, it just makes our analysis so much more difficult. So that's more a practical comment, really. On the question of non-integral versus integral joint ventures, I mean, I just wanted to kind of summarize what I think I said before. I think the split between non-integral and integral is really the worst possible option. I would like to see it all below the line just because the tax has been deducted, but I think I could live with above the line. But I think the split is really going to open Pandora's box. I think it's going to be highly political. You're going to have JV partners asking, why are we non-integral? And the other guy who to us looks less integral is classified as integral. Does that mean that, you know, you're really going to be dumping us? It's going to be causing all sorts of speculation about divestments, about rearrangements of the relationship and so forth in the marketplace. And I also think it creates more work for users because, as we said at the beginning, you know, we kind of do our own analysis. And so now this the input for that analysis comes from sort of two very different sources. And then just a final comment, and I'm not sure if you, that would really be my last comment in this PFS session. And I'm not sure when is the best time to address it, so I'll just kind of quickly state it here. What has cropped up really with the full year reporting season is that tiny nuances in contractual arrangements can really determine whether something is booked as sales or as other revenue or as other operating income. So I was just wondering, you know, if that is something that you might just want to look into, because obviously a big idea behind this project is standardizing the P&L in a way that ensures that economically similar events get treated similarly. I sometimes get the sense in discussions with other groups that there is a bit of a misguided expectation out there that this project will lead to margin structures being comparable. And I think you obviously need to push back on that, because the margin structures really depend on the business model, and there's nothing that accounting can do to actually change that, and nothing that accounting should do to change that, because I think it's good that the margin structure already tells us what the business model is in a way. But I think, you know, the point that I mentioned about, you know, very similar economic situations popping up in different lines, that could potentially lead to some confusion and sort of like, you know, work a little bit against the main idea of the project. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Marietta. Bertrand?
Yes, thank you so much. Short comments. With regard to the integral and non-integral separation, as I stated earlier, and we have been discussed this in the preceding CIMAC, I have some reservation about the separation and between integral and non-integral. I will not go over there. We have made a lot of discussion about this, but I don't think that we could split between the other between the two. And in particular, not having profit after integral, I don't understand what it really means. The second point is about optionality, and in particular with regard to the unwinding of pensions. So I think it's a good idea to reduce optionality. Things should be clear. I'm not sure about where to put the unwinding of pension. Is it part of about? Is it a part of operating of operation or financing? I'm not sure about this, but we have to discuss this. And the third point is about cash and cash equivalent, and I think it could be within the financing section because it's part of the financing of the of any industrial companies. That's for me. But of course, I will. I can make further comments, but this is the main point I wanted to share with you right now.
Okay. Thank you, Bertram. Let me just check if there are any. Anyone else would like to respond to this question before we move on? Philip. Philip, you're on mute. Still can't hear you. If you look towards the bottom of your screen, you should have four icons there. Or there may be a mute. Still can't hear you. No. Do you have the four icons at the bottom of your screen? If you hover your mouse towards the bottom of your screen. No, we're not hearing you at the moment at all. Still not hearing you. Okay. Do you have? Can you see those four icons at the bottom of your screen? Yes, and it's okay. Is your headset unmuted? Yeah, that's okay. Okay. Perhaps we'll come back to you in a moment if we may. Okay, we'll try you again in a moment. Carleen, shall we move on to the from here then?
Maybe a few things I wanted to clarify in response to some of the questions from members. So I think from Jeremy on the investing category, I think that would generally include things that are not consolidated. Include the non-integral associates and joint ventures, and usually returns on financial instruments to which you apply IFRS 9. Then I also wanted to respond to the person that asked about hedge accounting. So in the slides, we don't talk about how hedge accounting would work, but we do have more detailed guidance on that in the exposure draft. And generally, the guidance says that you would put the gains or losses on your hedging instruments in the same category as the category that's affected by the risk you're trying to manage. But we do have more guidance on that. On Marietta's comments, I just wanted to just clarify that so all associates and joint ventures would be below operating profit, just to clarify, so that that split between integral and non-integral is a split that happens below operating profit. So none of the two are above the line. So yes, I think those were the things I wanted to reply to.
Nick, if it's okay, I would like to make a couple of comments as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
So hi everyone. So just a couple of comments that you made, Florian, and the first I picked up is, as I understood, suggesting to only move financing expenses that relate to operating up and not allow this optionality. And I just want to share that we had a fair amount of feedback along the lines of what you have just said, because I think there is some concern that you could, this basically leaves room for companies such as manufacturing companies to put all their financing costs into operating, which clearly is not a particularly useful outcome. And maybe just to give you some background as to why this is proposed. So as Karin explained, these proposals are meant to fit the banks. They're also meant to fit companies with multiple business activities, such as a manufacturer that has a captive finance arms. And in our outreach with banks, they told us there is no way, because banks themselves have several activities, banking, investing, etc. And they said there's no way they could tell us, or they could split money funding between funding of loans to customers, which is their financing, which is what would meet definition of provision to financing to customer, versus funding of their other activities, such as their investing activities. And it is really on that basis that the board said, if we give accounting policy choice, we expect that banks, regardless of the number of activities they have, they would put probably everything in the operating. And we expect that somebody like manufacturer captive finance arms that usually has these as quite distinct operations, they would quite easily be able to separate, and it would be in their interest to separate. So we expect them to separate, but I think you're quite right that the proposed standard doesn't require you to do that. It just is accounting policy choice. So we are doing field work on this to test how it would apply in practice. And, we have been encouraged by some to think about ways that would more go along the line of forcing these other companies to make the split when they can do so, and perhaps leave the banks alone. Although I have to say some users have also expressed skepticism that banks can't do this. They think they can, but we are conducting outreach with banks as well about that. So that was the point on the financing. I think just to echo again your comment on the investing being potentially confusing, because there is investing category in the statement of cash flows and it's quite different. I think it's another fair point that we will need to consider. And is there a way to bridge that gap? And I just want to comment on all of your comments on integral and non-integral, because if I understood correctly, I haven't heard anyone speak this morning in support of this proposal, and please correct me if I was wrong. And we have actually, in the course of outreach since December, heard support for this from some users of financial statements. So I just, if I may, Nick, just throw this back out there, and if there is anyone here on CMAC today supporting basis for this proposal, and leaving aside the question of maybe having more guidance to have better comparability of the outcomes, I would just like to hear some more about this.
If there's anyone who would do that now, we are on a very tight timetable this morning, so perhaps if anyone has any strong views on that, please follow up with email or speak now.
Nick, we could do that as a follow-up poll to members. That's 30 seconds to do.
Okay, I suggest we do that then. So, Carleen, could you move on to the next section?
Yes. So the next section starts on slide 21 and is about disaggregation. So investors have been telling the board that sometimes information in financial statements is too aggregated and that they don't get the information they need. And so the board is proposing to strengthen the requirements for disaggregating information in the financial statements with a set of proposals that are listed on slide 21. And I would like to highlight two proposals in particular on slides 24 and 26. So on slide 24, the analysis of operating expenses. So we are proposing to strengthen the existing requirements that are already there on by nature and by function presentation of expenses. So first of all, on the face of the income statement, we're proposing to clarify that entities are supposed to present expenses either by nature or by function, and that is not a free choice. So there we would provide a list of indicators that entities would need to consider to determine which presentation is the most useful one. And then we are also proposing to clarify that companies are not supposed to mix by nature and by function. So the only case where you could end up with a mix of by nature and by function if it's when a company does by function on the face, and then in addition it provides some of the required minimum line items that we're proposing, or even that are in IS1 already today, such as the impairment of financial assets. And then in addition, investors have told the board that they want complete information about expenses by nature for all companies, even the companies that do by function on the face, because by nature information is easier to forecast than by function expenses. And so the board is proposing that companies that present by function on the face would also disclose a note that has the total operating expenses disaggregated by nature. And on this proposal in particular, the disaggregation by nature in the notes, we've already received significant pushback from preparers, because some of them say that it would be very costly to provide such information because they don't capture that type of information today, and it would require system changes if they want to do so. So when we come to the discussion, it would be very helpful if as a user you could express how important this information by nature for all companies is to your analysis. And then the second topic on disaggregation that I wanted to highlight was the proposals on unusual income and expenses on slide 26. So many companies today present or disclose some sort of similar information. So they provide information about non-recurring income and expenses or exceptional income and expenses. But investors tell us that information today, while it is helpful for forecasting future cash flows, it varies significantly, and it's not always clear whether items have been identified as unusual on a consistent basis. So what the board is proposing there is to provide a definition of unusual income and expenses, which is in the top box on slide 26. And this definition, it is based on whether the information or the income and expenses have limited predictive value. And it is forward-looking only. So it only looks at whether you expect the income and expense to arise in future annual reporting periods or not. And so also on this proposal, we've received some pushback from preparers that the definition is a bit too narrow or too restrictive. So for example, they say that if you apply the definition and you have a restructuring program that affects two reporting periods, then you wouldn't be able to classify that as unusual income and expenses, and they see that as too restrictive. So again, if you comment, could you express whether you feel like the definition that we're proposing is capturing the right things, or whether it's too broad or too narrow, or should be different in another way. And so the board is proposing disclosures in the notes about unusual items, and specifically an entity would be required to disclose where in the P&L they have included unusual income and expenses. So there's an example of that on slide 27. So that brings us to the questions on disaggregation. So just to repeat, there were two things that we specifically wanted to hear your views on, which was how important is this information about expenses by nature for all companies to your analysis? And do you think the definition of unusual items captures the right things or not?
Thanks, Carlene. So again, if you're on VC, if you'd like to raise your hand now, if you'd like to speak to these questions. Philip and Anthony. And then if you're dialing in, please could you indicate now if you'd like to speak to these questions?
Yes, please, that's all.
Hello?
And Paul as well, please, Nick.
And Jeremy, please.
Okay.
Dropping out here, please.
And sorry?
Dwell here, please.
Yep. Okay, great. Yes,
and Bertram.
I've got you, Bertram. Excellent. Well, let's start with you, Bertram, then, please.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I will make a comment on the by nature and by function. Clearly, I have a preference for by nature, because as you said, it's much easier to forecast and to compare between companies. I have an issue with the buy function because still a lot of the cost of goods sold still represent a large share of operating cost, and it's very difficult to compare and to forecast. One other issue is that about the disclosure, because when the company presents in the primary financial statement the information by function, and then you will have the information in the notes. But I understand that it will be only for annual reporting, and if I'm not wrong, there will not be that information for interim financial statements. And the second point is that often, not always, but often companies, when they do present their results, do not present the financial statement at the same time, sometimes it's 1 week later or 2 weeks and so on. So this by nature information, even for annual reporting, will not be available when the company, the issuer, are presenting their financial results. And this is an issue. So clearly, to have this information within the interim financial statements will be a plus, and we will like to have it. This is my comment.
Thanks, Bertram. Joel?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, thank you. Yeah. Go ahead.
So on the by nature or by function point, I agree with the preference for by nature. And however, I would say that I'm not sure I'm convinced by the approach of requiring a disclosure of by nature in the notes. If by nature is going to be done in any case, I would have a preference for just the one option of by nature, period. And on the definition of unusual, I do agree with the point that was made that it can be seen as too narrow if it is required to be something that affects just one period. And on a more general point, what I wanted to say as well is that given there is already a definition and a term of unusual item being defined, why not put that through the operating profit definition as well? I mean, if it's something is unusual, should it be included as an operating as part of the operating profit? And in my view, it should not. So why not excluding that from the operating profit?
Okay, thank you. Anthony, please.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I'm just, and maybe this is just because I'm new, but maybe you could make it clearer to me what you mean by the actual separation between nature and function, and that way I can better provide you with some feedback, if you don't mind.
Colleen, would you like to, could you respond to that?
Yes, so there are two methods for presenting expenses in the income statement. So by nature, you present your expenses by type of inputs typically. So you would see line items like employee benefits or staff costs and depreciation. Whereas if you do by function, then you would see a cost of sales line item always. And you'd have line items that effectively represent functions in your business and their allocations of costs to those different functions. So yeah, typically cost of sales, SG&A, lines like that in by function.
So you're talking about the different components of that go into cost of goods sold, for example.
Yes, so those different inputs would be different natures, yes.
So I would say that that's very useful information, because it's always bothered me trying to track even the amount of depreciation that might be included in cost of goods sold or amortization, because companies will allocate that. And then, you could just comparing between companies, that becomes difficult. One will include more, a bigger proportion, and at least then you can get an idea of that the impact that it's had on the calculation of the gross profit or whatever you're trying to calculate. So I think that's very useful. I don't know that it needs to be right on the face of the actual primary financial statement. I like the idea of having it in the notes. Underlying expense. So that would be useful, I think. So now that I understand, that would be my comment on that.
I think just to clarify, I think the proposal isn't precisely as you describe it. So I think the proposal is, if you report it on the face by function, so you would expect to see cost of goods sold, SG&A, in the notes, you wouldn't break down those categories. You would separately provide a breakdown of expenses by nature. So it's not quite what you're asking for. It wouldn't allocate the depreciation between those different functional lines. It would simply provide another view of expenses in addition to the view by function. Alongside that, you'd be able to see a view of expenses organized by nature.
Okay. And there's an example of that. Is that what I see on slide 25?
So that is exactly. Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yes.
So the idea here is it's breaking down all the operating expenses. It doesn't necessarily show where they are allocated on the face of the statements necessarily.
Correct. Indeed. Yes.
So it's giving you a different sort of presentation of what's going to show up on the income statement as different categories, and you don't know necessarily where they're included. Some of them might be individually disclosed and some may not. Right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, I understand better. It's useful. To get the better disaggregation.
Okay, just wanted to clarify that. Let's go to Paul next, please.
Thanks. I was just going to talk to the unusual items question, and I think the definition that you're providing is useful. I don't think it's unhelpful that. It's restrictive. In fact, I think it's just to be clear with my language, I think it's helpful that it's restrictive. It's not surprising that preparers are worried about that. But I don't think that should constrain you from going forward with this definition. You know, there will be nothing that stops them from explaining very clearly why it is that, that actually items that are not capable of being excluded under this definition should be excluded in our minds and in our understanding of the business as an ongoing business. You know, they will be obliged to communicate much more clearly, and we as investors can then take a view as to whether we agree with that explanation and take it on board or don't. And I think that discussion and dialogue that will come from having this tighter definition will only be helpful.
Thanks, Paul. Let's go to Philip.
I suppose the first question is, can you hear me this time?
Crystal clear.
Perfect. Thank you, Nick. Well, I'm disappointed to be the first IT disaster of the day, but at least we've got it resolved. Maybe if I can just go back to the comment I was going to make last time, just to say that, you know, I'm very supportive of the format of the P&L, and maybe just to give some background as to what we do at Moody's. Basically, we have pretty strict definitions, and the definition that we use most is EBITDA. But EBITDA is basically anything which isn't tax, depreciation, amortization, or interest expense on debt. So everything else goes into our definition of EBITDA and what we use consistently across the board for all corporates. So, you know, I think that's very much where you're going. So again, very, very supportive of that. On the unusual items was the only other comment that I was going to make. And again, very much agree with what Paul has just said. Again, just to let you know what we do at Moody's, we take quite a skeptical approach, particularly for things like restructuring. And we tend to think more about whether, you know, back in old UK GAAP, where we had fundamental restructurings. So if a restructuring is fundamental and you're actually changing the business, then potentially that restructuring has more of an unusual nature. But if your business is basically the same before and after your restructuring, so you're selling the same things to the same customers, but all you're trying to do is streamline the business, then we see that as much more of an ongoing cost. And, you know, that could be perhaps because the way management have run things, they may have waited a long time before they decided to streamline a layer of management and then decided that that was a, you know, an unusual item. But in fact, they could have, you know, and another business may have done that, managed that differently going along and taken that out as they're going. So we tend to look at what have you changed in the business and have you in fact changed anything in the business. But, you know, very much agree with Paul, you know, you've got to look at what information they give you and take your own view at the end of the day.
Thanks, Philip. We'll go to Jeremy, and then after that, we'll go to Coy. But Jeremy first.
Jeremy here. But I think the ideal thing, I think, as has been mentioned, would be more of a matrix. So expenses analysed both by nature and function, so we can see where everything goes. And just one example on this, why that's potentially very important. If you look at research and development, and we want to think about capitalising it as a user, it's very helpful to know how much research and development is restructuring cost and amortisation, for example, because these are not necessarily things we want to capitalise. And I've seen in the past sometimes R&D as an absolute number has gone up. That's only been because of increased restructuring rather than increased investment. So that's one example where it would be helpful to get those splits. And in terms of pushback to preparers, I imagine that all of these information would be available on their systems. Thank you.
You may well imagine that, but the board did indeed discuss a matrix structure as an option, and the message came back very, very clearly that this was prohibitively expensive to do, and actually, for many, the systems simply aren't sufficient to do that today as much as it would seem to be ideal. Even as things stand today with the existing proposals of simply providing, in addition, the breakdown by nature, we still get pushback on the cost of that. Yes, Corey, please go ahead.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes. I think that operating profit should not include the unusual item because equity analysts focus on sustained profit generated from main business activities when evaluating enterprise value. At present, analysts are calculating sustained profit by making their own adjustment with except unusual items. So I would like to propose unusual items should be presented as a new line of the peer statement rather than in the footnote. And the place to present in the profit loss statement should be just above the pre-tax income. If unusual items are disclosed in the footnote, almost all users will end up calculating sustained profit using information from the footnotes. So it is better to present it in profit loss statement. That's all.
Okay, thank you, Koi. Let me pass back to Carlene then. Thank you.
Shall I move on to the next topic, or Aida, did you want to add anything?
If I may, Nick, I just want to comment briefly about unusual and operating profit, if we have time, but...
Yeah, briefly. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, I'll try. You know, I struggle sometimes with being brief, but it's. I think I heard a couple of comments why is unusual in the operating, and I'm quite well aware that this is not current practice in some jurisdictions in particular, and it will be a change. And the view the board took is the operating profit is meant to represent results of operations, as the name says. And the fact that something is not going to happen in the future doesn't mean it hasn't happened in the period. It's a recognized expense in that period. And therefore, to be faithful representation of what has actually happened in the reporting period, what are the costs of your operations, what is your operating result, it only seemed right to include all income and expenses. And the way one analyst put it when we spoke to him is saying, look, I quite like this approach because it tells me about stewardship. And then I go to the notes, I think to the point you made, to get my, let's say, sustainable profit for going forward for my forecasting. So it was felt that this kind of approach gives you the best of both worlds in a way, although you don't have unusual on the face, but combining the notes and the face, you get complete picture. I could say more, but I will stop.
No, that's great. Thanks, Aida. Carlene, why don't we move ahead then to MPMs? Thank you.
Okay, so the next section on MPMs starts on slide 30. So as you know, many companies already use management-defined performance measures, or sometimes called non-GAAP measures, in their communications with investors. And what we've been hearing from investors is that such information is very useful to their analysis, but they say that the transparency and the discipline around such measures could be improved. And so what the board is proposing is to define a subset of those measures as management performance measures and require disclosures about those measures in the notes to the financial statements to improve their transparency. And so if we look at the proposed definition of MPMs, so of management performance measures, which is on slide 31, you can see that the definition has different components. And so one that I wanted to highlight specifically was in the top box. You can see that MPMs would be subtotals of income and expenses. And that is explained further on slide 34. So that means that it would only capture things like adjusted profit or adjusted operating profit, but it wouldn't capture non-financial performance measures. And it also would not capture things that aren't subtotals of income and expenses, like, for example, ratios or adjusted revenue items and things like that. So it's quite a restricted scope. then if we go back to slide 31, another part of the definition that we see as important is the first box on the left, so that MPMs are measures used in public communications outside financial statements. So the aim with that part of the definition is to create a link between the financial statements and information used outside the financial statements, so in communications with investors. And that's really our hook to bring these measures that are often outside the financial statements inside the financial statements, where we think they that would be the right place, because there they would be subject to more discipline and in many cases also audit. Then slide 32 gives an overview of the proposed disclosure requirements. Those disclosure requirements may look quite familiar. They're similar to some of the existing regulatory requirements in some jurisdictions. And the most important disclosure is the reconciliation. So each management performance measure would need to be reconciled to the most directly comparable subtotal specified by IFRS standards. And slide 33 shows an example of such a reconciliation. And for each reconciling item that's shown, the company would also need to disclose the individual effect on tax and non-controlling interests. Some investors have said that that's very important information to allow them to calculate adjusted earnings per share figures. Then if we move to slide 35, the board is also proposing amendments to the standards on earnings per share measures. So the standard currently allows companies to disclose adjusted earnings per share measures, and the board is now proposing to restrict what the numerator of those adjusted earnings per share measures can be to either subtotals specified by IFRS standards or management performance measures. And that way we ensure that investors would get the same information and adjusted earnings per share measures. Because on earnings per share currently only has a more limited list of disclosure requirements. So that brings us to the questions. One thing I wanted to highlight is that we've been getting pushback on these proposals in general on management performance measures from some regulators, auditors, and preparers. And specifically, it's the scope that they have questions about. And so some also question what is the added value of our proposals, given that many jurisdictions today already have pretty good regulatory requirements on non-GAAP measures. So it would be helpful if in your answer you could express whether you think that our proposals would add value, and where would they add value compared to the current situation.
Thanks, Carleen. So certainly from the perspective of the board, the intention here is to bring some more discipline and transparency to the use of those key non-GAAP measures. And I'd just highlight that the proposals on management performance measures very much complement the subtotals, or having a more structured P&L statement, in that it's those subtotals that provide the anchors for a clear reconciliation from the management performance measure back to the IFRS numbers. So let's proceed in the same fashion. So let's start with those who are on video. So if you would like to speak to these questions, can you please raise your hand? So it's Philip and Anthony and Florian, I have. And then if you have dialed in, can you let me know if you'd like to speak to these questions? And I see Gary's also waving at me. Anyone Joel, who's dialed in?
Can I say something quickly, please?
So I've got Joel. Anyone else? Okay. Gary, do you just want to start before we hear from CMAT members?
No, I actually wasn't waving, Nick. I just stretched my arm or something. This is for okay. This is for CMAC members.
Very good. Okay, thanks, Gary. Philip, please then.
Okay, just taking myself off mute again. Just a question, maybe. I mean, obviously, when I'm looking at these MPMs, probably the ones that I'm most interested in are things like free cash flow and net debt, which are not inside the green box. And I'm just wondering, the project's called Primary Financial Statements Plural. Why the cash flow and balance sheet measures have been excluded?
Aida, do you want to respond to that now before we move on?
Yes. I mean, and again, this is a comment. I think this is common comments we've been hearing during outreach, and no doubt we will have to review. But as Nick just teed up the board's position, it's these proposals are very much complementary to what proposals are on P&L and the new subtotals. And therefore, it made sense to kind of limit the scope, therefore, to those that complement those numbers. And I think, and it doesn't take away anyway from the view that, you know, the measures, in particular those that you mentioned, are particularly useful. And I don't think that's what we are saying in this project. But I would say if we were to consider measures such as free cash flow and net debt, then the approach and, you know, disclosures that Caroline has run you through would have to look quite different, because, you know, free cash flows, does it make sense to reconcile to P&L numbers, or would some other reconciliation then be needed? So it's just kind of different game entirely, which is why at the moment we said, okay, let's start with this. It's already quite controversial idea, as Caroline mentioned, bringing this in the financial statements, and you know, and we do have significant pushback around how will this work, how will auditors audit these numbers, and so on. So it made sense to kind of start small, so to speak.
Okay. I mean, I certainly like the ideas. I'd just like it to be wider ranging to cover the balance sheet and cash flow. And in terms of how would you reconcile free cash flow? Well, I guess you would reconcile it back to the subtotals in the cash flow statement. So that's the sort of thing I'm thinking of there.
I mean, I think there's a moot point in terms of what is a measure of when do you cross the line between a measure of performance and a measure of cash flow? At what point does one become the other? And I think that's something which I'm sure will crop up in the feedback. But generally, in terms of this project, I think the board made a strategic decision to focus on the statement of profit and loss. There is more that could be done in the cash flow statement, certainly. But the view was, let's take the wins which we have already here, or the proposals we have, and let's try and complete on those, and if we need to come back to other elements, the primary financial statements, let's do that at a later date. But it's a very valid observation that you make. Anything else, Philip, or is it just that?
No, just that.
Okay, thank you. Anthony.
Thank you. First a couple comments and then some questions. So I can tell you this has been a bee in my bonnet for our organization for at least the last 4 or 5 years, the use of the non-GAAP metrics and the fact that companies are not following even the securities guidelines here in Canada with the necessary reconciliations and so forth. So I think I commend the board for trying to step out of the comfort zone and trying to do something to ensure some compliance. But what I'm wondering is, how is this going to, leaving aside the scope, and I get the point that it's just profit and loss, and I think I agree with you, let's take a win at what we have. But how is this going to play with what we discussed earlier, which is the subtotals that are on the face of the financial statement? So we're going to allow some sort of subtotaling, which was sort of non-defined specifically. So would this then require a sort of expand beyond what's on the face of the financial statements? That would be my question.
Carlene or Aida, would you like to address Anthony's question?
Yes, sure. So it's so what, as I understood your question being interaction of the MPM proposals with subtotals, additional subtotals that may be on the face that are not defined by IFRS standards. Is that right?
Yeah.
That companies can add. So there is potential overlap here. So we have, with the new structure, new subtotals that are defined or that are specified, for example, operating profit before depreciation amortization, which are not required, but if company uses it, it is not an MPM, as Caroline explained. But there is also scope for companies to introduce additional subtotals on face, however, only if they fit in the new structure. So, for example, as we just discussed, you couldn't do operating profit before a new usual items. If you want to use that measure, it would only be an MPM, but you could have something like operating profit before depreciation, amortization, and say impairment. And because this is not labeled as IFRS specified, this measure could then potentially also be an MPM. So you could have some of these MPMs communicated on the face as well. This doesn't take away any of the requirements that Caroline has run us through, which is provide reconciliation in a single note and all related disclosures. So that will all still be applicable because we heard a big message that having everything in one place is very important success factor for these measures. But I just want to stress that we expect there will be a reduction in the number of measures that companies can present on the face in addition to IFRS subtotal simply because of the limitations of the new structure.
Okay, and so this is going to raise some questions on the audit side too, is how are the auditors going to audit these MPMs when there's no real necessarily any standard that they're going to audit to. How have we thought of that interaction? Because that's been a lot of the pushback and discussion that we know we've had here in Canada.
Yes. So with that, there is a couple of points. And, you know, we have done the rounds with the big audit firms. We've spoken to all of them now, and there are differences in views at the moment. So I think for them, it's because in the disclosure requirements proposed include also explanations of how measure has been calculated and so on. So in a way, companies own accounting policy. So auditors' work there is in a way mechanical, just making sure. So I say this is what the measure is and what it represents. And then my job is to verify that they actually follow through and they've calculated and the numbers correspond to what the narrative says the numbers correspond and that this is faithfully represented as such. So I would say some auditors, perhaps not all, feel, yeah, we can do this. It's just instead of ISB, it's company setting their policy for this and we are checking that they've applied this policy. I think where they struggle is this link with public communication. So if we, when we had this definition on the slide, so we said this is the measure that it has to be used in public communication outside financial statements. And the reason we brought this into definition is to create alignment between non-GAAP measures in the front half of the report or in press release and the measures that are in the accounts, so not to create opportunity for people, for example, to avoid regulatory guidance and create a third set of measures in the financial statements, potentially. So it was really just alignment. But we heard concerns here in that public communication is read as a very broad concept, and that in addition to annual report and press release, which are the first thing we think of when you say public communications, there is many other things. There are many calls, and auditors have some concern about having to make transcript of all these calls and having to gather all the tweets and what know what to actually say has company used a measure that then we need to check with them, why is this measure that you communicate, why is it not an MPM? And maybe I'll just use the opportunity to highlight this doesn't mean all measures used outside financial statements would be an MPM. because we have components of definition. So as we said, it's limited to subtotals, so that takes away a scope a lot. And then also the measure has to, in management view, communicate an aspect of performance that it purports to communicate. So it's a management view brought in. And the reason we have done that is because we understand that in some jurisdictions there are measures that companies have to include in the accounts because regulators ask them to do. For example, some regulators defined adjusted earnings per share and require companies to present this in their management commentary. And, you know, we just wanted to allow opportunity for management to put their lens through that and not automatically include every measure, but say, okay, in our view, these are the measures that communicate performance, and therefore those only those measures meet definition of management performance measures.
Okay, this is it's going to be interesting to see how this all interplays, given I know there's concern both on the accounting side and on the audit side here in Canada related to use of non-GAAP metrics and so forth. So I'm interested to see how this plays out, but I'm fully supportive of where this is going. The issues with AI, EPS, just to talk about that as well, I think that's very good because this is very often I've seen analysts get confused and or fooled by how the EPS is calculated, and that they think it's comparable, or they may even think that it's a GAAP number, and it's not a GAAP number the way it's calculated. So I think providing some kind of structure to how EPS is calculated is critical. It's probably, you know, EBITDA is definitely the most used numbers whenever we survey analysts, but EPS I think gets quoted most often by press and or other onlookers. So I think trying to put some framework around EPS is critical. Anyway, enough from me. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. Let's go to Joel next, please.
Hi. I'll be brief because I think quite a few of the comments I was going to make have already been made. I generally agree with the proposal being very useful. If anything, I would reinforce what Phil said. I believe it was Phil in the beginning who said, if anything, in a later stage, if we can have an even broader scope for that, it would be very positive. And maybe just one clarification on the part of, for example, EBITDA being one of the key measures that we're talking about here, one of the most used ones. The operating profit before depreciation amortization, as it was defined, if I understood correctly, that's not a subtotal and it's not required. So will there be therefore a requirement that if the company decides to use an MPM as an adjusted EBITDA MPM, we would then be required to publish an operating profit before depreciation amortization just to reconcile with that? Or we would then pick another one, probably operating profit itself, to reconcile to?
Do you want me to take this, Nick, or do you want to go through the rest of the questions?
Briefly, if you could, that would be...
Yes, so very briefly, so there is something we call IFRS specified measures, and this operating profit before depreciation amortization is one of those. So like you say, it's not required, and companies could, if this is the closest, most comparable subtotal to their MPM, they could reconcile to that. So in your example, adjusted EBITDA, for example, could quite likely be reconciled to this number. The reason we are not requiring specific disclosure of this number is because depreciation and amortization already require disclosures by the individual standards dealing with these topics. But, you know, to your point, we have heard some calling for this to be included in the same notes so users don't have to go around the notes and find these depreciation and amortizations if companies don't put it on the face. So we'll take that into account.
Great. Thanks, Ida. Florian, please.
Yes, so thank you. I'm very supportive of this. I think especially the part of extending it to external communications is key. So, I mean, I'm always comparing it to Regulation G that the US has. it seems that the US guys, companies actually are able to manage the reconciliations even in their press releases. So I'm not really sure why the European guys or the rest of the world shouldn't be able to. Thereby, I think this expansion onto the external communications is key here in this. And I think this is important because I think we find a lot of these measures more and more in things driving management compensation. We find it more and more in other areas, and thereby I think it's really important to get this into the auditing bounds. And I think the other thing, and I think we'll talk about it in agenda point four, is when we talk about strategy and how we measure strategies and how we, you know, what are the metrics, I think when we get to that type of discussion, I think it will be clear that it would be interesting in strategy, in the management commentary, then have a discussion around why is it exactly these measures versus anything else, right? So this is closing bracket, and we'll talk about that later, I think. Thanks.
That's great. Thank you very much. So Carleen, we have just about 10 minutes left. So if you could briefly introduce the questions on cash flows, that would be great.
Okay, so we only have two slides on the statement of cash flows. So on the statement of cash flows, in general, the board has heard various concerns from stakeholders, but the board concluded that a complete overhaul of that statement, which is what some people are asking for, was outside the scope of the project. So what the board is doing within this project is rather limited. So we're focusing on targeted improvements to eliminate some classification and presentation options in the statement of cash flows. The first one is that the board proposes to specify that if companies use the indirect method for the cash flow statement, that they should use operating profit as the starting point, whereas currently there's some diversity there. And then secondly, currently, the standard allows classification options for interest and dividend cash flows, and the board is proposing to eliminate those as explained in the table on slide 38. And then finally, a small improvement would be that in line with what we're proposing in the income statement, there would also be a split between cash flows from integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures in the statement of cash flows as illustrated on slide 39.
Thanks, Carleen. So if you're on VC and you'd like to respond to the questions on slide 40, can you indicate now, please? So I've got Anthony. Okay, and then if you've dialed in.
Yes, Bertrand, yes.
Yeah, thank you, Bertrand.
And Jeremy, please.
Yep. Okay, Jeremy, why don't you kick us off then?
Just a short point. I support the standardization, but on the interest received point, I think it would be useful if that was specified as a required line on the face, so the user then can put it in a financing if they choose to. So this really echoes the point in the income statement as well, is that the ambiguous lines, if they were shown, then the user can also choose to reclassify very easily. And that's my point.
Thanks, Jeremy. Noted. Anthony?
Can you hear me?
I can, thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so I have to say that this issue of the interest drives me crazy, and I've seen... And I can tell you most users get fooled by this all the time, or many do. So the, you know, interest is always perceived to be conceptually as operating. And so your proposal to put it in financing and investing, I get it from a accounting intellectual standpoint, it makes sense. But from the way most investors that I've ever spoken to use and think of interest, they would consider it as part of operating. So I don't think you're going to help things by actually separating the two, having interest paid in one place, interest received in the other. You know, it's like saying we have cash in one pocket or the other pocket of the same pair of pants, and we can separate those in a company's business. So it's all one. They have some cash and they pay some interest. I want to know what the net amount is. It's nice to know the two proportions, definitely. Have them broken out in the notes is fine, but I'd like to know them in one place, and I think they should be in operating. Dividends, I think fine. Again, having them be in two places, I can see it from an accounting conceptual standpoint, but again, I don't know if we're trying to get too pure in our accounting and losing the point that the investor just wants to know in one place there's the dividends. I mean, if you can just think, most investors are using Bloomberg or some other metric, some other aggregator to get their financial information to begin with. So if they're using that, and then the Bloomberg picks up the one dividend and the other dividend, and they don't realize that there's two buckets and they should be netted. And anyway, I think that this could cause all kinds of issues. So anyway, those are my thoughts on what you're thinking about here.
Thanks, Anthony. And there was, we had quite a healthy debate around this issue at the board, I would say. And we've heard mixed views on this. Clearly, there's some who prefer to think of an alignment structure between the P&L and the cash flow statement, which I think is where the board has landed, but not everyone. Bertram.
Yes. Some few comments. I'm okay with starting with operating profit, and I thank you to do that, because now that the operating profit is well-defined, it could be a starting point. I'm okay also with reducing options, but it should be clearly labeled and clear for the user that where the things are. I have a question between the consistency between, as you said, the cash flow and the P&L, and in particular with regard to the taxonomy or the consistency of terms that we can clearly make explain and understand the difference between and the alignment between the cash flow and the P&L. I have a point. I don't know how you address this disaggregation issue with regard to the other terms that you have dealt with within the P&L. And sometimes we have some large numbers of others in the statement of cash flow. And finally, I think it's regarding also the issue of, I would say, the IS7 improvement to have a bridge between, I would say, the balance sheets and the statement of cash flow, that we can explain where are the numbers and where they provide and what is outside the statement of cash flow. That's all for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Bertram. Philip, I think you wanted to come in on this as well.
Yes, just trying to get myself off mute again. Again, supportive of taking away the optionality, and I understand the logic of why you've chosen to go with investing and financing. Again, just from our Moody's point of view, we have everything in operating because we're looking at sort of global peers and comparing with US. So we need a consistent definition, and unfortunately that's the one we've gone for. So, you know, if the information's there, we'll make a reclassification as we do with everything else. But just to support Anthony a little bit we would treat everything as being operating.
So just for the sake of clarity, what you're saying is that you would have interest paid, interest received, dividends received in operating in operating cash flows, and that would be consistent with US GAAP?
Yes.
Okay. And dividends paid in financing?
Dividends paid in financing. But we make those reclassifications at the minute because the optionality is there under IFRS as it is. So if interest paid in financing, we move it. So going forward, we'll have to move it for everyone. But it is what it is.
Yeah.
But that's because you're a sophisticated user. The problem is a lot of users don't necessarily pick up on that, and then they try intercompany comparisons and look at the operating cash flow being higher at company A than company B, and it's purely just because of the way interest is allocated. Anyway.
Okay, I think we've got the message. That's very helpful. Aida, Carleen, any last issues? We're just about out of time.
I just wanted to clarify, I think there was a question whether this irrigation guidance would apply to statement of cash flows, and I heard there was a problem that items are described as other there as well that are significant, and I just want to confirm that yes, it would apply to statement of cash flows as well as the notes.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you very much to everyone. That's very useful contributions to the discussion. What I suggest we do now is that we take a very short break, just over 5 minutes. We're due to start at 11:40 again, London time. And just remind you that you will still be, although you'll be muted, your cameras are still live during the break. But if we could come back in just over 5 minutes' time, that would be fantastic. Thank you.